Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace. And today I'm going to show you how to update a page with a giveaway. So as many of you will probably know by now, I'm going to be speaking on June the 6th at the Royal Armouries in Leeds, but a very kind subscriber has offered to fund a number of tickets for people who couldn't otherwise attend. So how am I going to do this? Well, there's lots of different options, but I've chosen to temporarily add a form. Now, you don't need to send me a message for this, so I'm just going to rename the form itself the giveaway form, but then I can just go into the form fields and choose which bits I want to include. So I don't need the message, as I said, just need name, contact information, and a subject line. And in that subject line, you just put conference giveaway, and that'll put you into a pool of people who may therefore win one of the tickets that the kind subscribers made available. Entries close at the end of Wednesday, the 3rd of June, to give you time to book your travel. And as you can see, I didn't like the square button, so I've just gone and switched that to a nice rounded button. And you can configure all the styles as you saw in the style editor. And I'm also going to move the button more centralized, so if people are using their phone, it's going to be much easier to spot than off to the side. And that's it, just save, exit, nice and easily done and updated with Squarespace. See you there. So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenefell. You can get a free trial, and once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show. Well, earlier this year, I held a naval history conference aboard HMS Belfast, and if you tuned in last month, you would have heard the opening presentation from Professor Andrew Lambert on iron bolts, and how appearance and artwork factor into power protection as much as the ships themselves. But since another month has rolled on, it's time for the second talk of the conference, and this is delivered by the excellent Chris from Military Aviation History, covering the Luftwaffe and their role in the war at sea. So enjoy.
Jack asked me to present. I thought this was going to be quite an easy job, because I'll just look at the Venn diagram of what's relevant to a British audience, what's relevant to me as an air power historian, and what's relevant to the Navy. And I thought that, I'll do something on the Channel Dash. And then I realized, well, I'm talking to a naval audience, and the Channel Dash is probably something that you know better than me. So I thought, okay, so we know what sort of happened with the Channel Dash, and we know what happened afterwards with increasing operations, aerial operations over the Atlantic. What about the period before that? And that's what I'm really going to talk about today. So I'm going to go to a big picture overview of the Luftwaffe's operational and strategic planning in terms of the Battle of the Atlantic, and also cutting off that artery into Britain with shipping before the Channel Dash, so that's early 1942. That, of course, goes into this sort of conceptual conversation of air power as power projection, using speed and reach in order to hit targets for decisive effects. And I also want to use this as an opportunity to dig a bit deeper and just have that radar versus Goering conversation, which, yes, this relationship between the Kriegsmarine and the Luftwaffe is overshadowed by that, but there's a lot of layers to this as well. Throughout the conversation here as well, very important, if you're interested in the subject and if you speak the crowd, there is an exceptional book called Der Einsatz der deutschen Luftwaffe über dem Atlantik und der Nordsee 1939 bis 1945. It's German. From Sönke Neitzel. And that's really the must-go-to source on this sort of subject. As I talk and go through the motions here, I want you to remember four things. First of all, Germany, when it starts rearming in 1933 onwards, has a continental focus. So it's primarily concerned with three countries. That is France, obvious, big military. Poland, still a big military for a country like Germany that doesn't have an armed force, that doesn't have an air force, that barely has a navy as well at this point in time. And Czechoslovakia even, because Czechoslovakia in 1933 is still a big power compared to Germany in terms of military might. So there's a continental focus, and it's about fast, decisive campaigns to prevent the opening of a second front. It also has to create an air force out of nothing. And there the focus is building a balanced fleet of mainly medium bombers that allow it to carry out those continental operations. And the focus is really to use it also as a political tool of power projection to prevent other countries in going to war with Germany as Germany launches its initial campaigns. And there, the sentence said by Goering to his own planners is, you know, when the Führer asks me about planes, he doesn't ask me what types we have, but how many. So it's really the size of the fleet that matters, rather than specifically what's in it. However, of course, the Luftwaffe initially has to go through various iterations in order to arrive at that very modern fleet that it has in 1939. There's also a power struggle between the Luftwaffe and the Kriegsmarine about who is in charge of aircraft. And it's the Kriegsmarine and amongst the most fierce opposition to the idea that the Luftwaffe could be an independent branch. And Goering never forgets this, and that hangs sort of as a specter over the relationship between those two branches. And perhaps somewhat surprising, in retrospect, Britain doesn't really turn up in German strategic thought as an adversary until November 1937, when Hitler says, well, we are now strong enough to most likely tackle the immediate threats around us and go onwards with our offensive campaigns there. So we'll probably have to worry about Britain in the future. So the Luftwaffe starts planning to that only from 1938 onwards. So just keep those four things in mind as we go through this. Now, I'm a bit of a nerd, so I like to read through doctrine. And that's sort of my first thing that I turn to when I try to understand what the Luftwaffe was actually trying to achieve on any sort of subject. And what we have here in the top right, that is the draft from 1945. It's Luftdienstwaffenvorschrift 16, Luftkriegsführung, basically means the conduct of an air war. And that is the doctrine that they have. And in there, it's written that the Luftwaffe basically has three overarching missions. One of them is supporting the operations of the Navy. And another one is to wage war against the centers of power of an adversary nation. And that is, if you want to see it sort of, again, as a Venn diagram, the military, the economic, and the political power of a nation. And you hit those decisively, and then everything falls apart. That's sort of the thinking behind that. But of course, the Luftwaffe also wages war, and it understands this, in the overall context of strategic operations together with the Heer, and if it has to, with the Navy. Then on the bottom right here, what we have is a document from the General Staff College of the Luftwaffe, where it conducts sort of its educational track for all the officers going through the different ranks. And there, the centers of powers are identified. And if we go sort of through that list, on the top we have industry, then we have energy, then we have communications and infrastructure and so on. And on the bottom we have shipping and ports. Now, I'm looking at this and I'm not quite sure if this is listed as priorities, but if you sort of look at this and you understand the Luftwaffe is a continental force, you kind of see where the priorities lay in that regard. Now, having looked at doctrine, what do some of the thinkers in Germany say about supporting Navy operations? And the Chief of Staff, Walter Weber, in 1945, basically says the exact same thing that I've already said that was penned in doctrine, but with a bit more focus on actually supporting the operations of the Kriegsmarine rather than waging a war against ports and shipping. And that is the general inclination that the Luftwaffe has, even after 1946, when Weber, as the Chief of Staff of the Luftwaffe, ironically dies in an aircraft accident. And it goes forward and it's maintained by Goering and the Luftwaffe as a whole. So this is not about a projection into the Atlantic just yet, but there is some scope here to explore anti-shipping operations, either by going out and destroying a fleet, let's say the home fleet, or by hitting the ports. So we've just heard about, you know, Copenhagen in 1905. If something like that would happen in 1940 or 1939, say, I think we can all safely assume that the Luftwaffe would have just said, well, let's go and sink them. And it would have considered that as supporting the operations of the Kriegsmarine and also then enable that maneuver of the Kriegsmarine into the Atlantic. And it ticks all the boxes and then it can go on to do its continental campaign. It's definitely not interested in any sort of long attritional air campaign. And this is a general issue with the Germans, is that they're always thinking these short campaigns because they have these fears of opening a second, maybe a third front, which they're definitely not going to win. So they need to knock adversaries out quickly. And even though Hitler changes his opinions multiple times, he himself has also said that in terms of Britain, an attritional campaign only against shipping, it's going to take 1, maybe 2 years to render any sort of results, and Germany doesn't have that time. However, not everybody agrees. There's a really fascinating meeting that it happens in 1938 between somebody called Ulrich Kessler, Oberst Ulrich Kessler, that's a colonel in the Luftwaffe at the time, and he's been identified by the Luftwaffe as potentially an upcoming chief of staff. So, presumably a very talented sort of officer. And he's invited by Göring to a meeting, and he's given the option to become the Luftwaffe attaché in one of the most prestigious postings that exists. That's right here in London. And what he's meant to do is come to London, have conversations with people in Britain, and try to understand a little bit the strategy of Britain, where are the vulnerable pinch points, and how that sort of information then can be used by Germany to wage a war against Britain. Now, Oberst Kessler at this point turns around to Göring and says, well, if we are at war with Britain, we are going to lose. Because Britain has the Empire and the Commonwealth, that means one third of the world is against us. And behind all of that, there's also America, which means half of the world is against us. We are not equipped and we are not able to win a war like this at any point in time. As you may expect, Göring didn't like that. So Oberst Kessler does not become the Luftwaffe attaché here in London. He does not become a chief of staff. He does become a general at some point. He's also the commanding officer of Fliegerführer Atlantik, which then later on carries out the anti-shipping operations, and then becomes an attaché in Japan towards the end of the war. So that gives you sort of an idea that not everybody agrees, and there are people in the Luftwaffe that voice their concerns regarding this, but they are definitely being drowned out by Göring and also the general thinking, the air-mindedness of the Luftwaffe. Now, having talked about that, with what would the Luftwaffe actually conduct such an operation? And as I said earlier, Britain is identified as a potential target in 1937, 1938. So the Kriegsmarine starts pivoting to that. There's a Z plan that gets muffled in many ways. Then there the U-boats come into play. The Luftwaffe, at the same time in August 1938, conducts a study. And they look at this problem set and they say, yeah, we're not equipped for this in multiple regards. The first of all, the medium bomber force just doesn't have the range and the payload to carry out these sort of operations. And all the long-range bombers have been cancelled for various reasons, but the majority, the main reason of that is that Germany understands that it cannot maintain, even construct and then maintain a large long-range bomber fleet at this point in time. There are soft pivots, so the Junkers 88, for example, is meant to become dive-bombing capable, or rather glide-bombing capable, and that is a clear sort of signal that the anti-shipping operations are being considered in more detail, but it's only one little piece in the puzzle. And then one of the big problems, of course, is with this medium bomber force, as I said, range. So Luftwaffe says, well, in order to have any sort of chance of hitting British shipping and ports, we need to have bases closer in. France is going to give us a massive problem, because nobody in Germany expects that the victory of 1940 will actually happen the way it happened in a couple of weeks. So what we'll need is bases in Belgium and in the Netherlands. And in fact, in November 1939, when the attack on France is cancelled for the first time, it is the lobbying of the Luftwaffe that then makes Germany add the Netherlands to the air invasion plans, because the Netherlands was, of course, neutral before that. And that at least provides some sort of staging points in order then to go out and hit British shipping. Now, let's assume we have the bombers that can more or less do that. Let's assume we have the bases that we more or less can do that. Then the Luftwaffe has the problem. They don't have any armor-penetrating bombs. They do have some mines, and the torpedoes that they have don't really work. So the F5 torpedo has a 20% failure rate at this point in time, and it's also such an old design that most of the bombers can't actually use it, because you have to fly very slow, and the only aircraft that can feasibly use it is a converted Heinkel 111 that becomes a Heinkel 115 with the floats. So it doesn't have the munitions. And this is a big problem anyway. So after the operations in Poland, the Luftwaffe is down to 50% of its ordnance stockpiles. After just that operation. That gives you sort of an idea of where the industrial capacity and the stockpiles were at this point in time, and why it was so important for Germany to win quickly in the early stages of their campaigns. However, I just talked about the Kriegsmarine having pivoted their production. What about the Luftwaffe? Now, the Luftwaffe assumes that if it pivots to a force that could reasonably take on Britain and destroy it just by an air campaign, because that is the aspiration of the Luftwaffe, then it will be ready by 1942 and will require more than 50 bomber wings. 30 of those will be reserved against land targets, and 13 of those will be reserved versus shipping. This is completely fanciful. Germany never has this sort of force. And just to add to that, most of these bomber wings were meant to fly the Henkel 177, which again, yes, there were quite a few of those built, but it never really worked out that way. And with the Henkel 177, as you all know, I'm sure, there's a very sort of hot and cold relationship with that aircraft. And there's some fascinating discussions happening already in May 1942, where in the Air Ministry, Milch basically says in one of the meetings, well, we're building this plane, but I don't really think we actually have a purpose for it. Why are we doing this? And they keep on building them. So yeah, that sort of gives you an idea of where that particular plan went. Now let's talk a bit more practically about the cooperation between the Luftwaffe and the Kriegsmarine. In January 1939, there's a consensus that is developed between the two branches, and that is the Kriegsmarine will venture out in the Atlantic and it will conduct its anti-shipping operations there, and the Luftwaffe will do the same in the coastal regions, hitting shipping there, hit the ports or land installations that are closely tied to shipping organizations, and also doing mining and an overall air campaign and an overall OCA campaign, so offensive counter-air against the RAF. All of those things Luftwaffe has to do at the same time, sure. But that's the consensus. The big problem there is, this is a consensus in partitioning the area of operations. So the Kriegsmarine gets the Atlantic, and Luftwaffe gets everything that is just west of Ireland, in the coastal region of Ireland, just to the west, and then going east from that. While this partitions the operational areas, it's not actually a campaign. And both branches are allowed, or, well, there's never actually any sort of agreement on that either, but both branches can pursue this at their own time, at their own intensity of their own choosing. So, yeah, that's not necessarily the ingredients for good cooperation and actually delivering some sort of strategic effect together as a joint operation. The Luftwaffe at this time of time also consistently changes the center of gravity that it has. It hits shipping, then it hits ports, then it hits the aircraft industry in Britain, then it hits the RAF, and finally it ends up hitting the cities, and then it conducts night bombing. So it does have a certain effect at some points. So in July 1940, it sinks about 40 ships around the channel and the eastern shores of England, 75,000 tons, I believe it was, altogether. And that does lock down shipping for about 5 days. Britain basically says, well, but let's not send out any ships for now, reassess the situation, and then a lot of these ships go out, venture out at night where the Luftwaffe can't do anything, and the effect basically fizzles out. And finally, there is actually, between these sort of operations in the Atlantic and in the coastal waters of Britain, there is no coordination, synchronization of efforts. And it's actually questionable whether that could have happened. Luftwaffe and the Kriegsmarine, they use different maps. They have different radio communication frequencies, and they use different encryption types. And there is no structures in place where the Luftwaffe people know what the Kriegsmarine is talking about if they tell them where ships are, and vice versa. Which is a problem, as you can imagine. And at the same time, the expectation of each branch for the other are completely different. So the Kriegsmarine wants tactical command, not necessarily own the planes, but tactical command of reconnaissance aircraft. The Luftwaffe sees that with suspicions because they say, well, this is going to be the first step in taking the aircraft away from us. The Luftwaffe, on the other hand, says, well, reconnaissance, what do you want to do with reconnaissance? If you have a plane over a ship, you may as well sink the ship. So they want to conduct strike operations. And that, of course, goes with the thinking of an independent branch. In order, if you send something somewhere as an air power, you want to destroy where you where you're sending stuff. So again, there is no alignment there in terms of what each branch wants from the other. Now, in July 1940, after the surprising victory of Germany in France, nobody's more surprised than most of the German generals. The first Staffan are being positioned in France for anti-shipping operations. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there is no coordination. In fact, what happens is that that quite often the Luftwaffe says, okay, Kriegsmarine here, have tactical command over various of our aircraft. By the way, tomorrow we need them back because we're going to bomb something in Britain. And that happens continuously. So Luftflotte 3 gives tactical command of various units to Kriegsmarine, only to take it back 2 days later for a week and then give them back and so on and so forth. So those are the sort of problems that happen there. Aircraft range is also a big problem. So there are two aircraft that have stand a reasonable chance to actually going out in the Atlantic. That's the Dornier 26 and the Focke Wulf 200. And the Focke Wulf 200 is not a military aircraft. And that's been identified very early on, but it's the only aircraft they have that can actually go that far. You're hitting a range of about 25 degrees west. So reasonably okay, but there is a lot of technical difficulties. In order to extend the range of the Dornier 26, for example, the Germans introduce catapult launchers. And on the first catapult launch, you know, because you can obviously add more fuel and more weight to the aircraft, but what happens is the first catapult launch, the engines seize or get destroyed, I don't know, as the aircraft launches, and it crashes. And so the Dornier 26 is out of the picture. And the Focke Wulf 200s, here one major problem is the crews aren't trained for maritime operations. The Luftwaffe has a monopoly on aircrew training, and they didn't consider maritime operations. So navigation over open waters, nobody's trained for that. Yes, there are some ex-Kriegsmarine officers in the Luftwaffe, but they are not sufficient in order to make this happen. And on top of that, with the Focke Wulf 200, the crews aren't night flying trained, which means that they have to go out in the morning and have to come back before night falls, because they can't land the planes otherwise. It's too much of a risk, really. So again, the window of time that the plane is out there in the Atlantic is incredibly shortened by sort of these training deficiencies. Now, there are results, of course, and I've put some of those down there. So you can see the Luftwaffe actually sinks quite a number of ships between August to February, as August 1940 to February 1941. Not as many as the U-boats sink at this time, but there is success. And one would reasonably assume now that this success is then seen as an indication that if a joint effort were to materialize, that could produce additional results. Not so with the Luftwaffe and the Kriegsmarine. Because Hitler momentarily provides the Kriegsmarine with additional aircraft and additional command authority over them, basically Goering is on holiday and he can't contest this move, Goering gets very, very, very angry. And he basically goes up to Raeder, and we have the protocols of this meeting. They're fascinating reading, really. But basically Goering says, yeah, sure, you can have the planes. I'll take away all the aircrew. I'll take away all your fuel. I'll take away all your munitions. You won't get any spoiled parts. Have fun with the planes. That's basically the choice that Raeder has at this point. And because Raeder is somebody who, by his own acknowledgement, doesn't want to challenge Hitler, he also doesn't really like challenging Goering, eventually says, okay, fair enough. The Luftwaffe gets their planes back. Now, Goering does all of this not out of a sort of aspiration to have the Luftwaffe really be the branch that conducts air anti-shipping operations, but just so the Navy doesn't have the planes and that he doesn't lose those, which is incredible if you think about it. But there's that specter again between the relationship between those branches, because Goering remembers that it was the Kriegsmarine who didn't want the Luftwaffe to be created. Beyond that, and I have to look at my notes quickly here, tactical and operational problems between the Focke Wulf 200s and the Kriegsmarine. So that's maybe the last point that I want to highlight here. There are 23 attempts between February 1941. February 1941 until July 1941 in getting U-boats to a target that was spotted by Focke Wulf 200s or vice versa. So there were some attempts there. One was successful. And if you look at sort of the margin of error that the Luftwaffe crew specifically have on their sighting reports, it's sometimes more than 200, 300 kilometers of where they say the ships are, where the actual ships then are. So these sort of problems keep marring the relationship between the two branches. And then, of course, as Fliegerflura Atlantic is created and Göring retains command of his aircraft, the focus shifts for the Luftwaffe again, because the Baltics are kicking off. And then in May 1941, the Luftwaffe gets ready for what? Operation Barbarossa. So all the planes that could theoretically have been rendered to this operation, with Heinkel 111s, who theoretically have the range to go all the way into the Irish Sea, an area that the RAF has not yet have the mass to defend, alongside a joint operation of bombing the UK from the Channel region, provides scope for additional anti-shipping operations, but it just doesn't happen. And that's sort of where it ends then with the Channel dash, and why eventually the relationship between these branches, yes, it gets better in part, but it never really is fully resolved. So if you have any questions at this point, please let me know.